always. There we are. Okay, now this is beginning tape 8, and this is Eleanor Swent continuing the interview with Frank Jaklik in Salt Lake City on January 19th, 1994. And curious about this. You mean to say you ran into somebody on the street and he offered you a job just like that?
Yes.
He must have been thinking about it.
Well, Amex was in need of someone because, you know, they were contemplating getting into a project in Australia, and they really wondered whether they should be doing broad scale exploration in Australia, and B, whether they should get into this project. They needed someone knowledgeable with mm-hmm. Australia to undertake this mm-hmm. work for them. And John Payne, you know, he was a very hard-driving, energetic man who's, and still is, I guess. I think he's retired to Tucson, Arizona. An eternal optimist, whose optimism was sometimes justified and sometimes not, but he was fully on board with the idea of establishing a bridgehead in Australia, and that's what they wanted me for.
Well, it certainly was a natural for you, it seems.
Yeah. So Pam and I packed up our goods and chattels in our apartment on East 49th Street in New York, and we were going to go to Australia the long way around because Pam, you know, had plenty of experience in various parts of the world, including Hong Kong, and we thought that on the way out there we'd do a little sightseeing, and it cost Amex nothing because in her position with Pan Am she could get free tickets. The only thing is you had to be what they call sublo, which means standby.
Mm-hmm.
So we cleaned out the apartment and got in a cab and headed out to Idlewild, as it was called then. And we looked back and saw the silhouette of Manhattan and mentally said goodbye. And the cab driver said, "Where to?" And Pam said, "Sydney, Australia." And the cabbie said, "I'm sorry, I'll have to phone in for out-of-town rates for that." And we got to the airport and found that the flight was full and couldn't get on the standbys. So we got another cab back to the apartment, slept on the floor, and took off the next day. And this time we were lucky and we got away. We went via Europe, and in Hong Kong we had a very pleasant stay. In those days in Hong Kong they got all the merchandise in from China, but US citizens weren't allowed to buy anything because it was supporting a country with which the U.S. had very strained relations, namely Communist China.
Mm-hmm.
So there were all these wonderful things to buy by non-U.S. citizens, as we were, and the prices were just ridiculously low.
Mm-hmm.
So Pam, who's never been backward in the shopping mall, so did some good work there, went on to Japan and then to Hawaii. And finally we arrived in Sydney on the, it was the end of April of 63. And let me just say what we got into in Australia in those days. And it happens, Lee, that when I flew back from Kuwait the other day on the plane, after I'd had a little nap, I made some notes. And I have a few pages of notes here comparing Australia pre-war with the Australia that we found
good.
In 1963.
Mm-hmm. And that's very worthwhile.
If it's okay with you, perhaps we could just take those into the
very significant
into
yes.
the record there.
Because you were going back this time to reside for the first time in
yeah
20
to actually live
almost
for the first
20
time
years.
25 years. See, 19. Oh, okay, you're right. When I left to come to the United States, it was 1953, so it was 10 years later.
10 years.
Yes, but I wanted to comment here generally on how Australia had changed in the 25 years since we first got to know it pre-war versus what we found in 1963. So these are some comments both on Australia and on Sydney as a city. Now, ironically, we didn't go to Sydney at first. We went to Melbourne because the first job was to look at the assets of a company with Aberfoyle Holdings. Whose main asset was tin mines in Tasmania. And I had seconded with me John Halbert and Ted Schassberger, a geologist and a mining engineer from Amex's mining group out of New York. And I'd said to these guys, look, we're going to Australia, fellas. This is a country with warm climate and you can, you know, dress lightly. This is how
shorts.
I remembered it, you know. As it happened, it was the beginning of May. We went down to Tasmania. It was bitterly cold. And we were wearing about three dress shirts, one on top of the other, because we didn't have much else. We nearly froze to death. We went underground there at Aberfoyle and at the Storys Creek mine, which was the other mine there. And they justifiably thought that I was a very poor tour guide and reminded me of that several times. Cut a long story short, we looked at that and we looked at the Green Bushes tantalite field, which was the other asset of Aberfoyle's in Western Australia, and at the Ardlethan tin field in New South Wales. And the three of us came to the conclusion that this was not a suitable vehicle for Amex's first investment in Australia. The news of this was tremendously unpopular back in New York, particularly with Amex's vice chairman, Elmer Funkhauser, who'd come into Amex only a short time before. And I will have some comments on Amex as a company at that time, but maybe we can defer that for the moment. And Funk, simply, as his nickname was Funk, and Funk namely simply said to Ken Craig, who was the chairman of Aberfoyle, now look, the technical people have had their say. That's the technical details. Now let's get on with it and make the deal, make the economic deal. We said, wait for us, leader. Don't do that, because we think we know something about the economics of this as well as the technological merits or demerits. Don't do the deal. And it was quite a contentious argument that took several months to head this thing off. And the painful part about it was that we thought the Aberfoyle people were very good nice people, and we hated to have put them through all the hoops of this exercise without coming to some fruition. And they were a public company, and we were terribly afraid news of this would break and give Aberfoyle a black eye. And Funkhauser wasn't prepared to let go at the New York end, and we were caught in the middle. John Payne was backing us, but in the end we won out, but we felt it was a bit of a Pyrrhic victory. Mm. Let me add to that by saying that Funkhauser was a good man, and we became good friends subsequently in the course of the Mount Newman exercise, but at the time it was very contentious indeed.
So you were given the responsibility of analyzing this and recommending whether or not they should buy it.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yes, it was a matter of yes or no. There was no in between. And on first blush, it had looked like a pretty good little company to get a foothold in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
The company that did that eventually was Cominco. Mm. They took an investment in Aberfoyle, and they were in there for quite some years, but eventually sold out their interest. It didn't lead to anything.
Mm-hmm.
I had had a good look at Melbourne, and you know, rivalry between Sydney and Melbourne is proverbial,
mm-hmm.
and I just couldn't quite warm to living for a substantial period of time in Melbourne. And I managed to persuade John Payne that we should set up shop in Sydney rather than Melbourne. Melbourne has the name of being the financial capital,
mm-hmm.
you know, far more serious place than Sydney, which is a far more beautiful and perhaps regarded as a more frivolous city. So there was some reluctance to that, to agree to that. But eventually he did, and I found an excellent office in the ICI building overlooking Circular Quay in Sydney Harbour, and we rented an apartment on Darling Point, one of the most beautiful suburbs, again pretty well on the waterfront, in about a few miles from the city. Furnished it. I scrambled around to line up lawyers, accountants, bank accounts, and all that stuff to have a presence in Sydney. And these were very exciting times indeed. By June, we were pretty well established, and John Payne and Andy Chandler came out. Andy Chandler was Amex's general counsel, and he was a man I had tremendous regard for and became very firm friends with, a brilliant lawyer, and the agreements that we subsequently made on Mount Newman and Kimberley for the development by international consortia of major resource projects in regions where no infrastructure existed, set the model worldwide for agreements for development of other natural resource projects that spawned all over the world. These agreements were taken as models afterwards, and they were largely the handiwork of Andy Chandler.
This is sort of the beginning of this big international,
yes.
multinational
yeah, exactly.
development.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Chandler wrote his agreements to last for 20 or 30 years. You know, really, he's a tremendous, had the tremendous ability of projecting the present into the future and surmising what kind of safeguards, what kind of provisions might be necessary 10, 20 years out. And by the same token, he was by no means a nitpicker. I mean, he focused on the broad issue. He could always fill in the details. That was easy work for him. He was a brilliant guy and a very good friend.
Now, Amex was kind of a new company.
Yeah, Amex was still surviving. And as I say, I'm going to give a little material on that. But
right.
it was surviving the bloodshed from the merger between the old American Metal
Climax.
Company and Climax Molybdenum.
Mm-hmm.
And believe you me, when I first joined, I didn't realize the infighting that was still going on. I only woke up to that months later, just how tough the struggle had been to form a cohesive company.
Mm-hmm.
Well, John Payne and Andy Chandler came out for a visit, and one of the things we had to do was to follow up on a visit some months earlier to Australia by Ian McGregor.
He was the chairman?
No.
No.
He was a junior vice president in Amex, in charge of project development or whatever. No, he had some business development. Junior vice president of business development. And what Ian McGregor had done, as far as I could tell from his account, that on a fairly idle afternoon in Sydney, he went along to the department, the State Department of Industrial Development, and sought out guy in charge there and said, "Hey, you know, I'm from Amex, New York. What's cooking here? Is there anything new going on?" And this guy scratched his head and said, "Well," he said, "there's a friend of mine, Charlie Warman, who I think has some iron ore deposits in Western Australia." And of course, Charlie Warman was the chairman of Warman Equipment, you know, Warman slurry pumps that are in use all over the world, wherever you go. The brilliant inventive engineers, all this equipment he had designed, invented himself, and now he was rather reluctantly running a large company, Warman Equipment, but what he really wanted to do was continue his engineering research. And as a little sideline, he had grub-staked a West Australian prospector named Stan Hilditch.
Two L's?
H-I-L-D-I-T-C-H.
Just one L, okay.
And Stan had gone out there first prospecting for manganese, and in the course of that he came across some iron ore deposits in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. And I'll talk a little bit more about that once I describe that project, but in the meantime, when Payne and Chandler came out, we met with Stan Hilditch and with Charlie Warman and discussed the possibility of a joint venture.
You hadn't seen it yet. You hadn't gone out there.
No, no, certainly not. These were very exciting times because apart from establishing the office there in Sydney, I hadn't even hired a secretary. So Pam, in the little time we'd spent in Melbourne, had taken a secretarial course, so she was able to type fairly slowly, and she came into the office and did the typing there for me. And across the corridor from my office there was Continental Oil, and Bud Abbott ran that from Texas. And after a few weeks, Bud ran into me in the elevator one morning, and he said, "Frank," he said, "there's something I want to tell you." He said, "Look, this may be embarrassing to you, buddy, but your secretary is noticeably pregnant." He didn't realize we were married. So, anyway, but Pam hung in there and continued to do the typing there for quite some months until I eventually got a secretary who happened to have been in Canberra Sir Harold Raggett's secretary before he retired, Isabel Winkleman, and she was a great gal, and she took over from Pam in time. But I can tell you that those days in Sydney, the start of the Mount Newman project and the other things we were trying to do really made the blood flow in your veins. I mean, it made you feel very much alive, because I must admit that the last year or so in New York on these changed assignments, even though each one was interesting in its own right, didn't give you the impression that you were particularly leading in one particular, in a certain direction, as I had in the Hearts Range, as I had in Canada. But that time in New York was more or less sort of itsy-bitsy and wasn't...
This is Eleanor Swent continuing the interview with Frank Joklick in Salt Lake City, Utah on January 20th, 1994. Okay.
When John Payne and Andy Chandler first came to see us in Sydney.
Now, Andy Chandler was the counsel.
He was the counsel.
And John Payne
was vice president of exploration.
Charge of exploration. Okay.
Yeah. And they came to see us in Sydney in June of 1963. We, that is Pam and I, had moved into our apartment at Darling Point, and I had established the office at Circular Quay in the ICI building.
And you had mentioned Isabel Winkleman.
And she eventually took over from Pam as my secretary. One thing I should say about Pam is that her background was birth in Scotland, in Edinburgh, and when she was still a little girl, they moved to Birmingham in England, and that's where she went to high school and then went on to university. She was very interested in sports and became captain of the English university's netball team.
Now, what is netball?
It is the English form of basketball.
Basketball, okay.
She was clearly interested in leading and whatever she did. I mean, I recognized this in her very early. She worked at Harrods for a while in London, and then applied for a job at Pan Am, where there were hundreds of applicants, and she was one of very few selected. And she flew for Pan Am, first as a stewardess and then as a purser for 3 years. And when I first met her there in New York, she was flying all over the world, and I was also, with my travels, covering the world pretty effectively. So we had chance encounters in the strangest places. I used to say that if we both traveled long enough, we were eventually bound to meet each other. And that's how it seemed at times. And when we eventually got married, she kept on flying for a few months after that. And then after we arrived in Australia, she resigned. And so this was her first experience as a homemaker there in Sydney, and she immediately got hit with floods of visitors from the United States and European countries, and we found ourselves entertaining at home almost constantly during these first few years in Australia. But anyway, we got set up there at Downing Point, and she came to the office with me every day to do the typing. There was a tremendous amount of correspondence. And when John Payne and Andy Chandler came, we had them at home, and then the following day, I believe I met with Stan Hilditch for the first time. Now, he was Charlie Warman's partner. He was the prospector who found Mount Newman. And Stan and I became, over the years, very good friends, and way past my involvement with Mount Newman, we continued to take every opportunity of visiting with each other in the United States and in Australia on our trips until Stan's death 2 years ago. Stan was a tall guy with a very strong, hard body and a face full of character. Sometimes when I saw him standing in the field, I almost thought of Don Quixote. He had that kind of air about him. He had, as I think sometimes happens with people who spend a lot of time in the outback in Australia, he had these blue eyes that always seemed to see way beyond the horizon. He was a dedicated morning person, as I incidentally was and am too. And I remember at the camp at Mount Newman, sometimes getting up very early, say at 4 o'clock to start preparations for the day's work, but Stan would always beat me to it. He'd already be there by the stove and have a pot of tea cooking, and he'd always greet me brightly with the admonition that this was the best part of the day. During his prospecting years, he was accompanied everywhere by his wife, Ella, who was a very hardy and a very kindly person. Stan's background was pretty varied, actually. He had at various times worked as a gold miner, prospector, of course, but he also had at one stage run cattle trains. This was I'm talking about road trains here, where these articulated trucks, three or four in a row, would cover hundreds and hundreds of miles in the outback, bringing cattle from the range to market. This was first introduced, I think, in the 40s and 50s, and Stan played a major part in that. He also owned and ran a hotel at one stage. So he was a man of many parts. I don't think he had that much formal education, but he was not only very interesting, he was also a very interested person. And he had picked up an awful lot of knowledge in the course of his very varied life, and was always an extremely interesting conversation partner. When in the days when we had the Mount Newman project going, in the evenings after dinner, he and I would sometimes go on long walks through the road into Mount Newman, through the desert, sometimes 3 or 4 hours, just discussing in great detail what was going on, what the future held, and which Range Rover, a considerable breadth of subjects. He did well financially out of Mount Newman, out of the deal that we negotiated with him and Charles Warman. most of it was in the form of future royalties, and he took the present value of these royalties as payment and invested that money in a cattle ranch in the on the brink of the Great Dividing Range, about 200 miles north-northwest of Sydney, and developed a stud farm there, which became a model in Australia, specializing in Charolais and Simmental cattle. And this was really his avocation, and he worked very hard at that until he was well into his 80s.
Wow.
And made a great success of it. And between these periods of working on his ranch, he and Ella, and after Ella died, about a year after that, he married again, a very nice lady who became a good friend of us. And he and his, he and Ella, and then he and Edna would do these major world trips.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was in Russia and in China half a dozen times. He could tell me stories about, I thought I knew the globe reasonably well, but by the time he died, he certainly had a much better knowledge of it than I did. But anyway, so much for Stan, because he was to play a very important role in the ensuing development of Mount Newman, of the iron
now,
ore deposits.
What was Mount Newman? Was there a town there, a city?
No, there was nothing there except an abandoned station homestead. That was all.
Okay.
And let me just give you a little background on that. Australia, until the Second World War, was virtually unexplored for mineral resources. And Australia had, and still really has, only one steel company, BHP. One might almost call it monopoly.
BHP.
Broken Hill Proprietary Limited.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the source of ore for BHP's blast furnaces was the Middleback Range in South Australia, and also the Kulin Island deposits off the coast of West Australia, both with limited reserve.
Might have missed a little bit the during and after the Second World
during
War.
During and after the Second World War, placed an embargo on exports of iron ore. That was partly engendered by the fact that when Japan came into the war, Bob Menzies was already the Prime Minister, and he allowed exports of pig iron to continue for a short time after the entry of Japan into the war. And the unions seized on that as a label for Menzies. He came to be known as Pig Iron Bob. Of course, he quickly realized that this couldn't go on, and vetoed any further exports. But the government therefore became very sensitive to the limited nature of iron ore resources and the products from it, and therefore there was there were no exports permitted. When Stan Hilditch first came into the Pilbara region, which is the name for that general region that the Hamersley Ranges are in, he was first exploring for manganese ore, because there didn't seem to be any point exploring for iron ore when exports were not permitted. But he found very limited quantities of manganese, but ran into these ranges that seemed to be made totally of iron ore instead. He discovered Mount Whaleback, which is the main Mount Newman iron ore deposit, and he named Mount Whaleback himself because it looks like the back of a whale. He discovered that in 1957. But he couldn't acquire a title because there was an embargo on what they called prospecting authorities for iron ore. And this embargo was not lifted until 1960. And he and Charlie Warman then applied for these prospecting authorities, or otherwise called temporary reserves, in 1961 and 62. That's when they acquired title to the iron ore deposits. And then they looked for possible participants in the development of these iron ore deposits. They looked to Japan, because there certainly wasn't any interest in Australia, and made a deal with a small Japanese trading company called Rasa Trading Company. So when Ian McGregor first...
So the embargo had been lifted...
1960.
1960, and
right.
They were able to sell to Japan then. Okay.
No, they were able to at least... make
deals
with
them.
So when Ian McGregor, as I related before, made contact with Charlie Warman late in 1962, the first thing that was clear was that the deal with Rasa Trading Company would have to be undone for Amex to be able to make an arrangement with Warman and Hilditch. So this became our first...
Why couldn't they just take over that?
This became our first objective.
They couldn't just take over the arrangement with Rasa? Amex?
Well, I mean... takes two to tango. I mean, Rasa had to be willing to do so.
Okay.
Now, let me just comment on the involvement of the Japanese so early in this process. Mm-hmm. As I think I've indicated before, ever since the end of the Second World War, the ties with Britain started to loosen, and the realization dawned on Australians that for its primary exports, wool, wheat, minerals, Japan was the land of the future. Japan had traditionally relied on its iron ore imports on the Philippines, India, Peru, and Malaya. All of them at that time fairly small and not very reliable producers. On the other hand, the Japanese steel industry didn't amount to much either. After the war, it took quite a while to recover. For instance, as late as 1955, Japan imported only 5.5 million tons of iron ore, and this by 1963-64, which is the period we're talking about now, that had increased to 31 million tons. And the projections
doubled
for the future, no, from 5 million to 31 million tons.
Oh, much more than doubled, yes.
And the projections for the future were sort of logarithmic. Sky seemed the limit. And the Japanese were hyping the rate of growth, perhaps to foster international competition. But at any rate, these discoveries in the Hamersley Range came at a very opportune time, as the supplies from Philippines, India, Peru, and so on were really tailing off rapidly. And before the great Brazilian discoveries had come on stream, there was a void there to be filled, especially in light of the extravagant projections of increases in demand by MITI and the Japanese steel producers. Of course, what happened after Mount Newman ultimately came into production and beyond is another story, and I'll make a few comments on that down the road, because that's equally interesting. So at the time, the Japanese were calling for imports of iron ore, and a deal was made with Rasa Trading Company to substitute Amex for them.
Were you competing with other people in this?
Well, yeah, we
I mean, Amex was new on the scene.
We
will.
We were. Yeah, that's a very good question. There were two other consortia active at the time. One of them was CRA, who were ahead of us with the development of Mount Tom Price. And Mount Tom Price was the property at the time of Lang Hancock. Lang didn't discover Mount Tom Price, but he had acquired title to it, and CRA made a pretty generous deal with him. The other competitor was Mount Goldsworthy, which was a consortium of Consolidated Goldfields, Cyprus Mines, and was it Renison? I'll remember that in a minute. And it was a consortium of three companies. And the Mount Goldsworthy iron ore deposits were not in the Hamersley Range, but they were about 60 or 70 miles southeast of Port Hedland, much smaller deposits than Hamersley and Mount Newman, as it turned out ultimately, but they were the competition. And as I get into the development story of this, it'll be clear how they interacted. Our main objective was simply to get into the game and be able to make an offer to the Japanese that might attract their attention.
You wanted simply to get involved in the development of the mining. I'm thinking of the shipping, which was another big factor there, was how to get it from Australia to Japan.
Well, that wasn't the trouble. There was a excess of bulk carrier capacity in the world at that time, and shipping wasn't any problem.
But weren't facilities? Didn't they have to build facilities in Australia?
Oh yeah, but I mean, first you got to find the ore body before you get into the shipping part of it. So we nailed down this arrangement with Warman and Tilditch. And this was
you
done
might expand
in,
a little bit more on that. Were they being pursued by other people, or were they the suitors?
No, they weren't being pursued anywhere else. They had this deal with Raza Trading Company, but Raza, as I said before, was not just a relatively small enterprise, and they weren't going to be able to supply the major capital needed for the exploration and
there
development.
Were no other bids for this?
No.
You were the only ones that were interested?
Right. Yeah. And the deal with Warman and Hilditch involved some upfront payment, and then but the main part of it was going to be royalties at various level of iron ore exports. We were starting from scratch, and we figured we were 6 to 12 months behind Hammersley and Goldsworthy. The deal with Warman and Hilditch was concluded in August of 1963. And our first trip, my first trip to Mount Newman, was on the 21st of August. And that was flying from Perth, 600 miles north, in a single-engine aircraft, and I think I just had one assistant with me, and I'd made arrangements with Stan Hilditch, who was going to be at the site, that he'd burn a couple of tires and give us an idea of where to land. There was a strip there of a few hundred yards long, and we landed on it, and there was Stan. It was a very hot day with turbulent weather conditions, and Stan, recognizing that it had been a heck of a bumpy ride, always made a point of looking me closely in the face as he shook me by the hand as we landed, to see whether I was at all green in the face or not. Anyway,
so you had taken their word for it on this deposit?
No, not at all. Nothing was known about it.
Okay.
So we, Stan and I, hopped in his truck after a cup of tea at this abandoned station homestead, Mount Newman, and took a ride around Mount Whaleback. Stan says that his first recollection of me was that as we rode on this bush track for four-wheel drive vehicles around Mount Whaleback, we came on a tree that had fallen across the track, and I, with my Canadian experience, of course, as a matter of course, just reached for an axe, hopped out of the truck, and chopped this fallen log in two and cleared it away. And Stan just couldn't get over that because he thought, well, here's the big company representative from New York and clearing the way for me. That impressed him and helped, I think, to cement this friendship that lasted for a long, long time. So we took a look around, and of course there wasn't a single drill hole into this deposit, and that was the first order of the day, clearly, to mobilize some drills and start the exploration there. And the theory, looking at the deposit, was that this outcrop of Brockman iron formation, which is a Proterozoic formation of jaspilite, was enriched in places with hematite. In other words, there's a background content of iron oxide in this formation, and the theory was that due to probably surface processes, you had enrichment at the surface, which made these impressive outcrops of high-grade iron ore. And the theory was that this blanket, if you will, might be, say, 50 feet thick or so, and if it was extensive enough, you had a substantial tonnage of high-grade iron ore. And that at the time was still pretty much the theory. This theory of surface enrichment still held pretty much at Mount Tom Price, which was being actively drilled already at that time. And a few weeks after my first trip to Mount Newman, I went to Mount Tom Price, flew to Mount Tom Price, and met Lang Hancock there and the CRA geologists, and they were very kind and showed us over the deposit. And they at that time also had fairly limited impressions of the tonnage, potential tonnage they were dealing with because of this geological theory of the genesis of the deposit. Incidentally, on that day, after being shown over Mount Tom Price, we were due to return to the camp at Mount Newman that evening, but we left it too late. It was just the pilot and I, and the distance was, 150 miles or something like that. And we ran out of daylight. Mm. It got pitch dark, and we weren't anywhere near Mount Newman yet.
Mm.
And fortunately, once again, Stan Hilditch came on. He lit some fires and at the strip, and then guided us in, and we managed to land in the pitch dark.
Mm.
The manager at Mount Tom Price was Harold Jensen. He was a very capable.
And these were similar deposits then?
This was all part of this Hammersley Range iron ore province with the Brockman iron formation containing these makes of high-grade iron ore. So we then set about mobilizing drills, and we weren't quite sure at first what was the best equipment to utilize for just near surface probing down to a depth of maybe 150 feet. We used Gardner Denver air track drills, which performed very well. But then it came to probing deeper with down the hole hammer percussion rigs, and they were in very short supply in Australia at that time. We started off with Mayhew 1000 rigs and then switched to Reich, R-E-I-C-H, 500 drills, which performed very well. And what can I say, within a matter of a few months, by the end of December of 1963, we had seven rigs working on Mount Whaleback, drilling out a grid of 750 feet by 250 feet and producing huge quantities of cuttings, of course, that had to be processed and bagged and sent to Perth, where we had mobilized a assay lab, a small assay lab, and caused them to expand to be able to hand the volume of the samples that we sent them and return the results to us in timely fashion so that we could continue to plan our exploration program.
Did you have a manager out there that you had?
Well, we had, first of all, the first guy that I hired after advertising in the papers, the first person to respond who had the necessary qualifications was Ken Malcolm. Now, I knew Ken from before. He was a couple of years behind me at the university. And he graduated from Sydney University with honors and had been active in the, mainly in the aluminum industry, in exploring in the exploration of bauxite deposits outside of Australia in various tropical countries. He'd worked with Reynolds Metals for a long time. And he'd come back to Australia and settled in Perth and was looking for a job and was ideally suited for this. Ken was a very hard worker. He was also a good explorationist. One of these people who is not at all operations oriented. He was just interested in exploration. He ran the camp up there, or I should say he ran the technical part of the program, because we hired Stan Hilditch to run the camp itself. Ken did us a lot of good during the exploration years up there. Unfortunately, after that, and of course he also was the guy that discovered and then ran our Mitchell Plateau bauxite project, which was, which succeeded the Mount Newman project as far as my involvement was concerned. But after that he kind of got lost in the Australian minerals exploration boom, and he died very young. Very young. So we had Ken Malcolm, And then I hired a bunch of other geologists. Notable amongst them was Brian Summers, whose background was also to a large extent in aluminum. Ken actually referred us to him. Brian was a big guy, big bearded guy, extremely intelligent, an unconventional thinker, highly productive as far as turning out work, a very pleasant person to be with. He liked good food and good music. He was an excellent companion. And he also contributed very notably to our exploration at Mount Newman. He again had a very early, untimely end. He bought himself a little farm outside Perth as a hobby, more or less, and got working with a chainsaw up in a tree one day, and managed to slice through the artery in his thigh, and before help could come, he bled to death.
Oh my.
Again, died died very young. And then we had Jack Zani, Z-A-N-I, who came from the Kalgoorlie goldfields, and I'd known Jack for a couple of decades before that. He at the time was working at the Whitnoom asbestos mine. Whitnoom was to the west of Mount Newman and Tom Price, and had produced asbestos for quite some years. Now, of course, it's the subject of a big controversy over cleanup all these years later. But Jack was the chief geologist there, and he came over, a very, very stable, knowledgeable guy, and he helped us a lot. And Jack Neal, Ray Martin, there's one other name that I'm trying to remember here. A young guy called Ron McMillan had just come from Canada and got off the plane and walked into our Sydney office and said he wanted a job, and he seemed pretty bright and personable, and I immediately signed him up. The reason I mention Martin and McMillan, two young guys, is that they were really the ones that changed the geological thinking about Mount Whaleback with time, and this was very important, and I'll come to that in a minute. There was also a Yugoslav who was referred to me by Norm Fisher, Dr. Fisher in Canberra, a most unusual character. His name was Mili Savievich, and to spell that would be a very interesting exercise. But he turned out to be an excellent, detailed mapper. When we finally got down to mapping Mount Whaleback in great detail on a scale of 100 foot to the inch, he was just outstanding. Unfortunately, he had some ties or commitments back in Yugoslavia, so at the end of 1964, he was only with us about 18 months or 24 months, and he felt obliged to go back, and that was very unfortunate because he didn't really know what faced him when he was going back then. Lost track of him and never really heard. But while he was with us, he contributed very strongly. We called him Mike, I mean, because of his difficult surname. Mm-hmm. That was his given name. So we had this crew of people who were, you know, had varied backgrounds. None of them had really emerged as great leaders or anything, but they called upon to work as a team and produce a major result in an extremely short time, really performed miracles. And I found that throughout my career that if you just can give people the opportunity to work at their maximum potential and produce results that perhaps they never thought they'd be capable of producing, that they tend to rise to the occasion, but the opportunity and the incentive has to be there, and this is what we provided. And there was no question in their minds that I, even though I wasn't right at Mount Neiman, was very much part of the team. And that is a very exciting period there, 1963, 1964, when we started with an absolutely raw prospect. And in a matter of just over 18 months, produced the basis for an offer to the Japanese that shook Hammersley and Goldsworthy to a core.
And delighted you.
These were extremely exciting days, and I can tell you that, you know, leaping out of bed every morning with the challenges of the day to face was a great pleasure every day. The drilling then went on with the